Welcome to Writers Talking Screen, a podcast from the Writers Guild of Canada. In each episode, we focus on Canadian screenwriters and their art. Through deep dive interviews with the most talented screenwriters in Canada, we talk about the craft of screenwriting, go behind the scenes on the writing of a particular series or film, and cover the most pressing issues in the industry today. In this episode, award-winning screenwriter Amanda Joy will be talking to 2023 WGC Award winners in the comedy, drama, and teen-tween categories, Kurt Smeaton, Marsha Green, and Veronica Paz. They'll talk about how to handle rejection and success, tips for moving up from a script coordinator position to a staff writer, what not to do in a job interview, and so much more.
I'm going to take a minute now to just introduce our wonderful panelists. Let's start with Kurt Smeaton. Kurt is a writer, producer, and director with credits on over 150 episodes of primetime comedy. He created CTV's hit series, Children Ruin Everything, and recently served as co-executive producer on Kim's Convenience, Cavendish, and Schitt's Creek, for which he won an Emmy and a Golden Globe. Select credits include What Would Sal Do?, Young Drunk Punk, Mr. D, This Is That, and Space Riders, Division Earth. Kurt's roots are in live comedy, where he is one third of the award-winning sketch group, Falcon Powder. According to his bio, he is a lucky husband and father of three. Next, we have Marsha Green, was recently the co-creator and showrunner of the Emmy-nominated series The Porter for CBC and BET, which won a record 12 Canadian Screen Awards, including Best Drama Series and Best Writing on a Drama Series. An accomplished executive producer and writer, Marsha previously served as a showrunner on Lifetime's Mary Kills People. She was a co-EP on CBC's breakout hit Coroner, a producer on the ABC series 10 Days in the Valley, and a staff on shows such as Private Eyes and Departure. Next, we have Veronica Paz. She is an award-winning screenwriter and person. She received a Writers Guild of Canada Award for her work on Astrid and Lily Save the World, and has written for other shows, including Private Eyes, I Woke Up a Vampire, and the upcoming seasons of Doomlands and Wildcards. She is an alumnus of the Canadian Film Center's Primetime TV Writers Lab, and according to her bio, people describe her as somewhat young, walks fast, and hireable. So let's get into the discussion. Right off the top, let's start from the beginning. How did you get into writing? And was it something that you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I'll start. I'm just going to take a walk and let out my dog, who's came into the room, locked himself in the room, and now wants out. I started actually in live comedy. I was really big into improv. There's a great competition in high school called the Canadian Improv Games. And it's a national improv competition. Maybe some of you have heard of it or participated in it. And it really changed my life. I actually switched schools to go to an art school to be on the improv team there because it was the best one. and that was really a life-changing thing for me. It really opened my eyes to all sorts of arts, and I really got into acting and performing. And then when I moved to Toronto, I was in a lot of like live sketch and improv, and that was sort of, my bread and butter was acting in commercials. One day someone was looking for some improvisers to staff their room with, and I got the call, and the transition for me was really easy because in improv, you're generating a lot of ideas really quickly, and you learn to have no real ego about them. Like, they can be bad, and then you can just find some more ideas. And that sort of skill really translated well into TV. So that was where I got my start. That show, by the way, was a little curling show called Men with Brooms.
Nice.
And my first gig, yeah.
I'll go. I definitely always wrote, like, even as, you know, I've read a lot of books, and so I just really liked stories, and I would write stories about people in my class. And I always liked when I got to write in school or taking writing courses, but I don't think I really thought that I could become a professional writer. I just don't think, I don't know. I didn't know anybody who was doing that. I just, you know, it was kind of like, I guess I just thought that it would always be a hobby, that it would always be something. And even though I went to university and I was a creative writing major, and yet still I was actually in that creative writing major, the director of the program, like the first day we went to like the lecture, and he was like, "Do you know what the average author makes every year? $6,000. And it was just like, you know, I mean, which I guess is their way of like scaring people off from the program. And it worked. No, I finished, but I was very much like, okay, I'm going to get like a regular job and then I will write and do things on the side. And so I did do that for many years. And so it wasn't until later that I just, you know, I just wasn't happy not doing this thing that I loved so much. And I thought that before I like gave it up and like relegated it to a hobby forever, I should give it a real shot. And so, you know, I quit my job and I went back to school and I did all the things to try and become a screenwriter.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, similarly, I think I was always writing stories. Marcia just reminded me that I definitely wrote short stories that would get passed around my class. And then I bumped into one of my old classmates like 20 years later. And she was like, "You wrote some really crazy shit in those." So I don't know. She seemed disturbed. I don't know what I was doing, but it was definitely always a thing that I would do. And then, I didn't know that TV writing was like a job that you could have. I was really into live theater and like, sketch writing and live comedy. And then eventually I just sort of realized that, oh yeah, people do that for work and that can actually happen. I think that was like, I was like in my mid to late 20s by the time I was like, oh, I can actually do that. And then I just sort of focused my efforts into writing only TV.
What I love about these stories is that the three of you all came from very different backgrounds in terms of how you came to the industry. I mean, Kurt, you came from improv. Marcia, you came from academia. And Veronica, it sounds like you sort of followed the signs that life was throwing at you to get into screenwriting. I feel like this speaks to how diverse and experienced writers throughout our guild can be. And there's not a singular type of person who becomes a writer. That being said, what are the elements that you think make a good writer?
I think one thing that Kurt just mentioned is kind of letting go of your ego and just throwing your ideas out there. And like some of they're not all gonna slap, like they're not all gonna be good, and you just have to keep moving. Like you have, and I think, I mean, it's, I would say from me being in creative writing in university, we used to sit around like in a circle and everybody would read each other's stories, and then you would just sit and people would criticize, give you feedback on your story, like each person in the room. And sometimes it was like 20 people or whatever. So I feel like I got kind of used to that in the beginning. And just, you also get, I think what's good about putting your ideas out there, hearing the feedback, is that one, you yourself will get better at pitching ideas and it will become less painful. And the other thing is sometimes people won't like your idea and you will still like it. And that's good too, to know your own taste and the things that make you laugh, and you save them for one day that you're going to write your own pilot and put that joke in that didn't make it on Children Ruin Everything, you know?
Almost none of my jokes take on. Yeah, I mean, I just the ego thing is really, really important. And it's not just, you know, it hurts to put something out there and have someone say it's not good enough. It always does. And to find a way to sort of like be okay with that hurt and be okay to like move on quickly, not only from bad pitches, but from mistakes and even from successes, to like not get too into yourself. I think I played a lot of team sports growing up, and I think like my favorite rooms are when everyone's just doing it for the for the good of the show. And it doesn't matter where the idea comes from or how we get there. We just want to make sure that the showrunner's happy and we can go home at the end of the night, or that we're putting together something we can be proud of. That ego thing is really, really big, because it also, when you're spending those long hours together, hurt feelings and any kind of toxic behaviors really sort of fill the room like a fart. It's just it's no fun to be around, and it really kills the creative buzz.
Yeah, totally. And also, I feel like it's helpful if you actually enjoy the doing of the writing, as opposed to like doing it for the outcome, because you can't control the outcome. And a lot of the time when you're writing, there is no outcome. So, you spend so long just feeling like you're writing into like a black hole and no one ever is going to care. But like, if you have to really enjoy it. And I think that's been helpful for me.
I would say the other thing that I really like in writers, for me, like if I'm working with people or hiring them, is I very much appreciate the ability to share like your own experience and be vulnerable and those things. I just think it makes the stories so rich. And so, I always feel like actually in those cases, sometimes you're more likely to like get your pitch to land rather than like thinking about what would be good, but really feeling like what would be good, or like how you would feel, or something from your own life. I mean, I know that's difficult, but I do really like and appreciate when writers are willing to go there. And I think it really makes the work very special.
I think one of the hardest things for writers who are starting out, or maybe going into their first room or one of their first rooms, is dealing with the feelings of rejection. Because as we know, you'll pitch 10 things and maybe one will hit. Do you have any advice for writers who are just starting out on, as Kurt, as you said, being able to get over those feelings and manage them so that you can be creative and be a positive force in the room?
No, not really. No advice. No, I think like you just kind of experience it. I feel like here's the thing. It's so hard to get your foot in the door. And I'm speaking, I should preface everything I say tonight. I just want to preface that like my career has obviously been shaped and by privilege. You know, I'm white, I'm a guy, I'm straight, very handsome. So, that has shaped my experience. But I do know that it's very, very difficult to get your foot in the door. And then when you do get your foot in the door, it feels like you're under a microscope and every mistake you make is going to be leading to you being fired. And that's a really awful place to sort of start from and try to be creative from. So those first time in the room is figuring out the culture of the room and trying to figure out, when is it useful to speak? When is it useful to listen? But not be afraid to get in there and get your ideas in there, even if it's like sometimes creating the target for the thing that we want is knowing where the edges are, and the arrows that miss are just as helpful sometimes as the ones that hit.
Yeah, I feel like reminding yourself that you're a part of a team also really helps. It's not just about you. You're not alone. No one's like looking at you with a microscope. You're there as a one member on a moving machine on a team. So just focusing on doing whatever you can to help the team. And ideas come cheap. You know, you could have a million ideas and half of them are going to be crappy, and that's fine. You'll have a million more ideas.
I will say some advice I got on the first show I ever worked on that I thought was very useful to me was to kind of find my niche of like the thing I knew. So the first show that I ever worked on when I was in the writer's room was this show called Remedy, which was a medical show. And in that show, there was another writer who'd been hired at the same time as I was. So we were like both the two new writers. And she, like, it was like her dad was a doctor, her mom was a doctor, her uncle was a nurse. It was like that. It was like this long medical history. And I was like, I obviously had none of that. But on that show, there were like sisters who were very close and living together. And one of them was having a baby and I was living with my sister who had just had twins. So I was like, that's my thing. Like, it was also pretty much why I'd gotten the job. I had talked to the showrunner about my life. And then, so it was like, so then I didn't feel the pressure to like pitch a lot. Not that I never did, but I didn't feel the pressure to pitch all these medical things that I didn't really know anything about either. I felt like, okay, this is like an area I know. And that doesn't mean that every pitch was good, but it made me a little bit more comfortable to think about it in that way. Again, I could bring my own experiences in that situation. So that kind of helped. And I think also just being in that position and then being on the other side, it's like the person who hires you knows that you're new. So they're not expecting you necessarily to come in and have everything land. You know, they've hired you for something they've seen in you. And so to just keep remembering that and bringing that to it every day, because it's worse if the person comes in and doesn't say anything, you know, than if they're trying every day. And I think in trying every day, you do get better.
And yeah, and I think if you're just listening, sorry, I was just going to say, if you're just like, if you're in the room and you're listening, or you feel like, or if you feel like panicky, like, oh, I don't know if I'm being as talkative, or I don't know if I'm being as smart as everyone else, or I don't know, just like listen to what's going on, and maybe there's a hole you can fill, you know, like maybe people, oh, you realize, oh, people aren't really talking about structure today. Okay, well, you know, maybe you could focus on that and then you could sort of shift and fill that hole. Just sort of always being on your toes of how can I be the most helpful. Like I feel like that's always really valuable.
Those are all really great points. And actually something, Kurt, that you touched on was the element of privilege in a room. I feel like when you're running a room, or, you know, as showrunners, it's our responsibility to make sure that, you know, everyone is being heard. Everyone is being respected, making sure that, you know, especially I think a lot of times women don't have the space to speak, especially if they're new, and just creating that space for everybody and making sure that we're all being able to have our say, I think is super important.
I agree. I used to always have these days where I'd be like, I was like what Veronica just said. I was like, I would have days and I'd be like, oh my God, I talked way too much. Mm-hmm. And then like, I'd be like, man, I didn't say anything for like 3 hours. Like, it's like, it is, it's so nerve wracking and you don't know. And I worked for like very, very lovely showrunners who I think really believed in me. And it kind of gave me the confidence to speak when I definitely was, I mean, the first job, that was the other job I talked about was the first writer's room I was in, but the first kind of big opportunity I had was Private Eyes. And I started off as the script coordinator. So that balance of when to speak and when not to, when to be able to do your job and be excellent at that, but also not to get lost because you're an aspiring writer. Like, that's such a minefield. So I was really, I felt like very lucky to have, you know, my showrunner be really supportive, and also the other like senior writers in the room.
That's a tough job. That script coordinating job is incredibly difficult. And so I really have a lot of respect for people who can do it and also contribute narratively to the room. It's incredible. I'm so happy that there are more protections and benefits for people in those positions now, especially up in BC.
Yeah. Also, I've had script coordinators, I used to do this, and I had a script coordinator who used to do this too. When they would take the notes, they would add jokes to the notes. So then like I would like go back and I would see like little jokes that they added in for things that we were saying. And I used to do the same thing, which is just so random, but it's like keeps the job interesting and maybe, you know, makes your showrunner happy when they're like going back through the notes, trying to find what was that thing we were talking about that day? And they see like something funny. I mean, it's great.
On that note, a lot of people, I think, have a hard time breaking through from being a story coordinator into getting that first script. And a lot of writers who've been maybe working for a while have trouble making that leap into showrunning and producing. Do you have any advice on how do you break through to those different levels of career?
Sure.
Well, I can't speak from a showrunner perspective, but I could speak from someone who jumped from, you know, a writer's assistant to story editor. And I feel like, I don't know, a big thing that I did was I looked for any opportunity I could to be a writer and to like remind people that show that I was a writer. So like I wrote all the audition sides and I wrote damn good sides, you know, like I would do I would help with punch ups. I would write stuff for the art department. So it was just anything I could do. And I feel like it's helpful because it's, you're so busy as a coordinator. And I think it's easy for people to forget that maybe you're there because you want to be a writer in the room. So.
Veronica, that's such a good point that maybe people aren't aware of, that in production, there are so many other opportunities for writing that aren't necessarily, you know, writing a full script. And those audition sides are one where, you know, you're auditioning a character. Maybe they only have two lines, but you want to see what a person can do. So you create a bigger scene for them to be in. Sometimes it's like cold opens. We need a cold open or a tag and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And those are great opportunities to just like, and even if you hear that those things are happening, to sort of ask to be a part of that, that there's no harm in asking to participate in that kind of thing, to show your stuff. And I think most showrunners would be thrilled to give that opportunity.
I had a similar, like when I was that job I had where I was a script coordinator on Private Eyes, I did move to story editor. So I only did the job for a couple of months. And then one of the other assistants became the story coordinator and I became a story editor. And I do think that I both was trying to write other things. In those days, people were very into like digital like thing. Like they always wanted to have like the web series that went with your show.
The web some series, digital. Yeah.
Do you remember that? Anyways, oh, yeah. So I was like happy to write some things up, some ideas for that or whatever, because no showrunner wants to do that. Nobody wants to do that. No. And then also, I think it was the pitching in the room. Like from pitching in the room, it was like they could kind of see that I had good ideas, that I like knew the show and like knew how to, I mean, probably look, if you're a script coordinator, you've probably in this day and age, you've probably submitted a script even to get that job. So they know maybe it's like you can write whatever. So you're just kind of showing like, I get the show, I can do this. And so I think that that helped me getting a script, which then led to me becoming a story editor. So I think that is the kind of best way to transition at that stage. When you're, to me, it does seem very challenging. It feels like people are really getting stuck in the middle, getting stuck at like supervising producer or some of those higher levels and aren't able, and aren't getting the opportunity to jump to showrunner. And we talked about this in our EDI report last year. And it's, the information is there again in this one. And I feel like that it's a little bit more challenging because it feels a little bit less in your control. You know, everybody has to get approved by a network, you know, and they have to. So you really need. So I think that particular thing, selling a show like your own show, having a great agent, that might help. But I ultimately feel like we just need people to be creating more of those opportunities for people to move up. The first show I ever was a showrunner on that never got made, but was in development. When I did The Room, they just hired like a strong number two for me, someone else who had been a showrunner, so that I still got to be the showrunner, but I had a person there if I needed to ask them a question. And I feel like that seems to happen less now. It's more a co-showrunner or you're the second, but that was many years ago, but you know, I was fortunate that the producers of that show were just like, yeah, we're going to hire this up. And also very fortunate that that writer who was very experienced was willing to come on as the number two to help me. So.
Do you think that getting more onset experience also, like advocating for more onset experience, is helpful as well when it comes to making that jump?
Yeah, definitely.
It's helpful for you when you get there. You know, I think the big thing, the big difference here is like to rise up to the ranks and be useful on someone else's show versus being the creative curator on a completely original creative endeavor. There is a different skill set. Like in the idea, I think Marcia's right. We need more great ideas being made. And there's this weird sort of thing that's happening where, yeah, that number two, strong number two isn't happening. It's sort of like, I'll be the showrunner and your idea, I'll do your idea. and it's, you know, that makes it really difficult. But I do think, Veronica, you're right that like advocating for like, I'd like some time on the floor. I'd like to see the edits. I'd like to see the auditions and weigh in on the auditions and take it or leave it. Or I'd like to go to a sound mix or something like that. Even if that's not moving the needle for you on that particular show, to just have that experience to see actually what are the decisions being made, how much the show can change in that post process and get all that kind of like knowledge so that when you do get that opportunity, it's not the first time that you've seen, you know, a color correct. Mm-hmm. I think that's really useful. And I absolutely want to get writers on the floor. It was difficult during COVID, but now it's totally done now. So it's totally safe now. So yeah, it's happening more that writers can get on the floor and get some of that floor experience.
Great. I think that one of the biggest challenges for us as writers, especially as a lot of us are introverted, and since the pandemic have been used to working at home, is the interview process. It's a very different skill set from writing. And I was wondering if any of you had any advice for writers who might be going into an interview for a room.
I mean, know the show that you're interviewing for.
That's a good one.
Know the show, read the material, have insight, have things to say about it. Show them that you've actually thought critically about it and that you're interested in it. Find something about it that you can actually like, that fires you up. And then I think besides that, I mean, I try and just remind myself to chill out. It's fine. They just want to know who you are. You don't have to have a million tidbits about yourself prepped. Just it's a conversation. And I think the more relaxed that could be, then maybe that's better. I mean, I don't know. I've also interviewed for a lot of jobs that I haven't gotten. So I don't know. But generally, I feel good afterwards. But I'm like, okay, that was a win no matter what.
I think that like so when I was starting out, I would interview for jobs all the time and I would have these great meetings and I would never get the job. And one day I just said to my agent, I'm like, I don't understand. Like I go to these meetings, we get along, we chat, and it's just not translating into a job. And then she was like, well, maybe when you're like talking to the person, maybe like some of the things you're saying about yourself, you could translate to being about the show. And so I was like, great. And then I went for an interview for Kim's Convenience. It was like the first year, it was just coming out. And it was, I remember Ince said to me, oh, I see, you know, this woman, Carol Ricketts, who's an actor. It's like, oh, like, it was like, so obviously, I don't know, maybe he had looked it up and saw somehow a bus together. It doesn't matter. He was like, oh, I see that you know her. And I was like, yeah, I do. I wrote this piece for her. And I feel like it really shows the different styles and genres of things that I can write in, because that piece, and I was just like, it was the most terrible interview. I obviously did not get the job, because it's like, you know, what a person would say is like, oh, how do you know? Yeah, I do. We did this. How do you know her? But no, that never happened. I was just like, turn this into something that is like a selling point for myself. And the whole thing went like that. It was terrible. I did not get the job and I was not surprised. And then after that, I was like, you know what? This is just me co-signing this like chill added. It's that. It's like the harder you try, the worse it is. Be yourself, as terrible and as, you know, cheesy as that advice is. Just be yourself. Just relax. Go with the flow of the conversation. You know, you learn to ask you about yourself. But yeah, the things you connect with the show, if the conversation evolves and the person gets to know, I mean, so much of the interview is about getting to know you because we're going to be trapped in a room together on Zoom or otherwise. So it's like just being who you are is really the most important thing, and not trying to be or do anything as I did. And as a result, never got to work on Kim's Convenience.
You can't try to win the interview because you don't know, like, what, there's 100 reasons why they will or won't hire you that you can't control. Like, you don't know, there could be 10 people making that decision. You don't know who else they're interviewing. Like, all of that's out of your control. So there's no winning it. There's just make a good impression. Mm-hmm. Be a pal.
I feel like Marsha and Veronica said it all. That's totally right. Yeah, you got to hang out with that person. They just want to hang out with you and see if they can stand being in a room with you for 10 hours. Like, that's it. If you get an interview, they've liked your script, or they've, you know, yeah. So no more to say. Shut up, Kurt.
I was thinking maybe we could talk a little bit about the state of the industry on a more macro level. As we saw from the report that came out yesterday from the Guild, there have been changes, both good and bad, for writers of diverse backgrounds. How do you think, as an industry, we could better adapt to accommodate?
Well, I mean, certainly accessibility is a huge part of it. You know, we just have a way that we've always done things. And I don't think we've ever really considered the way like our processes don't necessarily kind of open the doors for everybody. And I feel like we've started to think about that a lot in terms of race. I feel like we've not thought about that enough in terms of disability. And so I think that's one thing that could really change. Another thing that bothers me a lot that I see is, like, I feel like there's like a very like matchy, like, oh, this show has an Indigenous person. So now I'm going to like hire this writer. And if there's no Indigenous people, then we don't need Indigenous writers. Like, you know, it's not like a one for one. Like, we should just be opening up the doors. It's about having diverse experiences and perspectives. And I just would like to see more. I think that's partially why you see the numbers that you do in our reports about it. Like, you know, when there's a show like Trickster, the number is very high. When that doesn't exist, it's low. And I just feel like we should always be looking to diversify our rooms in all of these ways. Even if there's not a person with a disability on your show, that doesn't mean that the person cannot contribute to the show, you know? So I feel like those two, I don't know, did I say two things? Anyways, that's my opinion of things that we could do going forward.
I feel like Zoom rooms have been a great opportunity to hire more writers with disabilities as well, and writers from remote communities who aren't necessarily based in Toronto and Vancouver. We have this power of technology that gives us so much more flexibility nowadays that I think it's a shame that the numbers weren't better in the mm-hmm. report, considering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to, I spoke with the participants of the Accessible Writers Lab. They very kindly invited me. And one of the things we were talking about was pitching. And so it was like, how do we pitch if, you know, we have, maybe if we needed, like, you know, say it was like, I'm not really that good. Cause it's like, you know, when you pitch, it's like, all right, you got to be on, you're like acting, you're doing the whole. And it's like, if that's not who you are or not available to you, but it's like, it's just like, this is the way we've always pitched. And so I feel like that was like, they were asking me and I was like, I have no idea. Like I myself had never thought about it. So I was so grateful to go, to speak to them, because it made me think about, okay, so if we're going to have, as we are having a pitching event coming up, what are the ways we can make this accessible to people? And what are the ways in which we don't accept pitches in this one way that maybe doesn't work for everybody and for all the reasons, like maybe they don't live in this city, you know, maybe whatever it may be. So I think it's been, I feel like there, it's been very eye-opening for me to be kind of thinking about it and learning about it more.
I think there are some programs that, and you know, there's BIPOC TV, film and TV, which have like show running programs and writing programs that help connect people. And there are ways to get people involved and get experience, but it's weirdly not weirdly, it's not translating to jobs. And I think, you know, it feels sometimes like there's this weird, like almost BIPOC fatigue. And I'm going to say it, like, it feels like sometimes people like, we're doing it. Oh, do we have to keep doing it? And I would love to consider, for people to consider, the strength of storytelling that comes from a diverse room. And it's not just about like doing someone a favor. It's about like getting different ideas, different voices. So the scope of stories that you can tell on your show grows. And it's a bit disheartening to see that the numbers, that the numbers are fluctuating down, and that's a bad situation. I just encourage those organizations to continue. I'll keep working with them. I guess I don't have any solution. It's a thing I've felt and noticed in talking to some other writers, that it feels like there was this sort of crest of like, it's happening. And then, I don't know, not so much anymore.
Yeah, I feel like it's just going to take a collective effort of like showrunners and producers to be actively thinking about how they're staffing their rooms. Because, yeah, if you're only staffing the people you've worked with a bunch of times before, you know, are those just a bunch of white faces on the screen? Okay, maybe start hiring people you haven't worked with before. Because I think there's a lot of talented BIPOC writers and talented writers with disabilities that, you know, you just need to maybe reach outside of your immediate network. And then we could just have diversity across the board, instead of what Marcia was saying, a BIPOC show is BIPOC writers and a non-BIPOC show is a bunch of white writers. It's like, that's weird. That's a weird segregation that I would like to not see anymore.
Yeah. And I think maybe I shouldn't be talking about this, but I also encourage people, BIPOC writers, to not feel like they're there to voice the BIPOC characters. Or that they have a responsibility to protect those characters, or that their job is different somehow than the other writers in the room. That's everyone's job, is to protect those characters. It's everyone's job to write those characters. And, it's everyone's job to listen if you have a comment about the authenticity of a moment, but it's not like you're not the guardian of of those characters. So I think that's, I feel like that, maybe it's difficult conversations and people just don't want to have them or whatever, but no end of that thought. Just spitballing, guys. Let's have a brainstorm.
I feel like among producers, and writers who are in producing roles, we could do better in terms of education on accommodations for writers with disabilities. I feel like, you know, we receive a lot of literature, we learn about things, we have workshops, but that seems to never be touched on how to make the workplace comfortable and accessible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it's like something that we've been talking about we have a joint committee, the WGC and the CMPA, a joint diversity committee, which is very exciting. I just find it exciting because so many times you're talking about things and you actually do need, as we say, like, as Veronica said, like a collective effort. There are only so many things we can do as the WGC. So having the CMPA start this committee with us, it was very, very encouraging. Anyways, but one of the things we have been talking about is like kind of asking about accommodations, like right from the beginning, and that it's not necessarily just for writers with disabilities. All kinds of people could need accommodations. And so by kind of creating that culture right from the beginning, when people are getting hired, you're able to capture perhaps what a writer with a disability might need, but also what your other writers might need, what a mother might need, what a single parent might need, or whatever, all of those things, these ways in which, you know, before we used to just, it was like, your life is this job now and everything. And, you know, we don't live in that world anymore. And that's a good thing. And to be really thinking about it from the beginning. And I think that, anyways, is something that we've been talking about at the WGC.
That's really great to know. And now just really quickly, because we have to get to the Q&A, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, in the wake of the American writers' strike, a lot of the things that they were protesting against were things that we already have here in Canada: development rooms and mini rooms, shrinking rooms, lower episode numbers. Is the current state of Canadian TV sustainable, or do you think that there will need to be changes?
I'll just say quickly, I just feel like because of being on council, it's like I, you know, this is obviously something we're talking about all the time. I think obviously, I mean, for those who don't know about Bill C-11 and the CRTC hearings that are happening right now, this is about regulation for the streamers. And I'll just say that could have a very big impact. I do have some concerns about the sustainability of the model as it stands, as the WGA did. And, you know, I think there were things that you said, which were similar concerns, mini rooms, people not going to set, as we talked about a lot, you know, they're writing everything, they're never getting to set foot and produce their episodes, and how that's not creating the pipeline that we want to create. So I do think there are some things in that sense that we can definitely work on and could change and could improve. But I think there's kind of a larger issue going on here in terms of this policy, and that I think would, you know, it will greatly impact the kind of state of the industry going forward, and hopefully, you know, result in more opportunities. And then more shows getting greenlit, I should say. So we just have a lot of development because we don't have a lot of places to go. You know, you write your show and then you're like, here are the three places that I'm going to, and then that's it. So having more opportunities, I think, would also improve the situation.
Call me a romantic, but I do believe that coming out of the strike and coming out of the strikes in the US, there are going to be opportunities in Canada as US production companies and broadcasters look for ways to make shows more cheaply. And I think there may be some opportunities for shows to get co-produced with American streamers and American broadcasters for shows that have Canadians above the line writing and acting and directing, producing, that are for American and global audiences, to be made in Canada. It seems, as from some discussions that I've had and meetings that I've had, that people are going to be looking to make shows for cheaper, and we're in a position to having to we've always done that. That's just always how we've done it. And so we have some experience that may be of value. And so I think that, you know, I know that it's not going to be a floodgate opening, but I wouldn't be surprised to see more American shows using Canadian writers and using the co-pro model to make TV.
That's something I think I've noticed as well, a lot more interest from American networks in doing co-pros, which is great for everybody here. Moving on to the Q&A, because we've got some great questions here in the chat. Here's one. I was wondering, how do you avoid conflicts with other writers if a writer is being overbearing and not listening to any of your ideas?
Bert.
That's for me?
I think that was for you.
That's my wheelhouse. leave me alone. I like being overbearing. I think that's really tough. It's really, really tough to feel that you are not being heard. And if we're talking about the showrunner in this case, it's very difficult, and it may be worth having a non-confrontational meeting to be like, why? Hey, I've noticed that my ideas aren't being listened to. Is there? And you can frame it like, is there a way I can make my ideas better? Is there something the way I'm pitching? If you frame it as like, I'm looking for help and advice, there might be some sort of conversation that starts. If this is a situation where you're being bullied by a senior writer, then I think like you need to talk to the showrunner or a producer and just be like, I want to work. I want to deliver good stuff. And I feel like I'm being stifled a bit. And that's a completely legitimate conversation to have. And there are policies in place on all productions to sort of deal with that kind of conflict.
Agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another question. As mentioned, with the current market in Canadian TV and staffing jobs being harder to find, what advice would you give towards selling or pitching your own original shows?
I think if you have a good idea, you should always pitch it. And what's happening in the world or like in the industry can change and does change all the time. People are like, this is what they're looking for. And then you take that out and they've got them all already. Or it's like, nobody's greenlighting these shows. And then next thing you know, one gets greenlit and then they're only greenlighting these shows. I think that you have to, I mean, this is one of the hardest parts of the job, right? It's a freelance gig and you never necessarily know where you're going to get your next job or your next opportunity. And the one thing that we have is our ability to write and produce work and put it out there. And I think that you may go out with the intention of selling this idea, which is very good. And that may not happen, but you might get staffed on another show, or maybe they bought a book and they were like, you know what? We're not going to, you know, we have this we have this IP. You'd be perfect for it. So sometimes being out there and putting your ideas out there can lead to other opportunities, or, you know, it's lightning in a bottle and you get the green light. You just never know. And so I think it's always worth it to not worry about what's happening outside of what you can control.
Worst case scenario, yeah, you end up with a great sample. And that's a good scenario. Yeah. So it's, yeah, and don't chase trends. That's always one that, like, I'm also guilty of, you know, like feeling like, oh, there's so many shows like this, or people are saying that this is hot right now. Should I do that? And it's like, well, if you don't have a good idea you're excited about, then don't try and fit something into some box because you think someone will buy it. Nobody knows what they want. So yeah.
It's true. But I will say that to make sure that, like, if there's a Venn diagram, it's something you're passionate about and something that's producible. You know, like, mm-hmm. 30 locations or, you know, a space pirate vampire show might, like, that's a very niche market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, I guess if you are thinking about, it's like, yeah, if you have a pilot that's very great, but very unproducible, it's probably not going, it's going to be a harder sell. That is just the reality. It doesn't mean you shouldn't write it. It just means when you put it out there, you might not sell it. It might just end up being a great sample, or it might get you another job. But so you do have to kind of find that marriage of like the thing that seems possible, you know, the kind, not necessarily, and I'm not even saying like the kinds of shows we make here, but an actual like producible, you know what I mean? That doesn't, like, we're not going to have the money to make, I don't even know. I'm like, I feel like I never watch expensive shows. What was that one with Priyanka? That one was really expensive.
Yeah, like a globe-trotting spy thriller.
Exactly. Like, yeah. That's probably not going to happen. And so, you know, like, that is something that you can keep in mind when you're really looking to sell something in this country, unless you have some connection for a co-pro.
If I could also add to that, I think when you're creating your pilot script in your Bible, it's really important to reach out to your own network before you start shopping it around, even before you send it to your agent. I think get the opinions of writers that you trust. And in my case, on the most recent one I did a table read with some friends who were writers so that we were able to hear it out loud. I think all of the steps and the efforts that you put in to improve that script right from the get-go will really pay off.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
Okay.
Sorry. My dog did it again. My dog did it again, guys. Get out of here, Smokey.
Dogs ruin everything.
Wait a minute.
All right.
Spin-off.
That's a spin-off, yeah.
Spin-off, coming up.
We have another question here. A lot of us writers know the feeling of rejection well in this industry, but we're less familiar with success. And it seems sometimes it's harder to cope with success because it's a less of a familiar emotion. Are there any lessons that you've learned to best cope when you started to get bigger opportunities? My answer to this is set aside more money for taxes than you think.
Yeah, that HST you're collecting is not for you. I'm going to have a very sad bit of advice, which is that it's really, really important to appreciate and really, really enjoy the fleeting success that you have, because it's so rare to get to do something. A showrunner told me when my show was greenlit, enjoy this. It may never happen again. And mm-hmm. So I've really made an effort to stop and smell the roses and think about, wow, high school me would just be so amazed that I'm doing this. That being said, I never make assumptions. The show's never coming back. I'm never being hired again. When this contract's done, I'm not back next season. Any show I'm on, I'm assuming that it's done, at any moment I'm gone and that I'm not going to be invited back. And so that came from being fired and from a show unexpectedly. And I've just sort of created this, I feel healthy. I don't assume that someone's going to bring me back. I'm going to start working on the next thing. I'm going to take this experience I've learned. I'm going to start making 2 weeks until my contract's done. I'm going to start making some phone calls. I'm not getting extended. And that's a scary, not fun way to live, but it's also, I feel the best way to do it, because you're just ready. You got a go bag in your mind.
Yeah. I feel like it's healthy. It's good to be at peace with that, knowing that a good thing can happen, but it doesn't mean anything beyond right now. It's happening right now. It doesn't mean you're set for life and you're going to have a million opportunities, The grind never ends, right?
Okay, your face just dropped perfectly. Or maybe you'll never work again.
I have to say, the feeling that every job is your last job, at least for me, never goes away.
Never.
Oh, man. I feel, I think definitely with the Porter, I can just remember it was such a whirlwind, and it was there were amazing things happening around the Porter. We were in Dundas Square and I was just whoa, this might never happen again. And not in a bad way, just in a this is crazy. What a gift to have made a show that, actually got that kind of press, that kind of attention that doesn't happen a lot. I've worked on many shows that I think are also very good, but did not get all of the fanfare that we got for The Porter. So it really, I was very aware of it. And I mean, I guess the only thing, other thing I will say, the one thing that I feel like I grappled with the most in terms of getting more opportunities was, it's like this thing that you love that becomes your business and your livelihood in this way. And so to just, I guess I keep, it's like keeping the love part of it. And also I will say that in terms of the hustling, it's to have hobbies. That's my advice, is to have hobbies. Cause let me tell you, the pandemic hit and I realized I didn't do anything but go out and network and try and hustle and get more jobs. And then all of a sudden it was I couldn't do any of that. And then I was what am I doing? And now I have all the plants and all the instruments in this house in an effort to find something to fulfill me otherwise. But yes, enjoy it. Yeah, I feel enjoy everything, but also you always want to keep, I think, that perspective of the other things that matter outside of success. And that helps soften the blows of the things that don't work out that you don't get. Oh, 6:59.
Absolutely. Okay, one last question then.
Okay, great.
Because in our industry, there are no job boards, how do those of you who are showrunners go about finding new writers? And what advice can you give those of us on the come up to navigate a process that feels inherently exclusive?
Great question.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry,
go ahead,
no, you go. Please go.
Okay, I'll go. I'm going to go. I think here's the tough thing. If you've got an agent, I think the idea, and even if you don't have an agent, if you've got a great script, I think the idea is to be in touch with production companies. Because whenever, the truth of the matter is, if you write a show and you've got a bunch of writers and the show comes back, those writers come back. And so I had a season two that ballooned in size and I was able to hire new writers, people I'd never worked with before. But then season three shrunk and I couldn't hire those writers back. And so there are sometimes opportunities, but the first place I go to is my agent and my production company. I'm like, who are you guys working with? Who do you like? Because I want to read some scripts right now. And it's going to be a very short process of me reading a dozen scripts and then meeting three or four people. So if you're sort of meeting with production companies and getting your scripts out there and keeping that relationship alive, then you are in that sort of bank of writers. Like, you should try reading this person that they have for their shows. So that's one way is to have those relationships.
I think that is exactly right. Most of the time, the reality is you're just the agents are sending you people and the production company is suggesting people. Those are the number one ways that people are getting hired. But I will say that when I did The Porter, I ended up, one of the writers in the room was this writer, Andrea Scott, who I had mentored in like a program years before. So she did get submitted, but I already knew her. Like, we'd already worked together. And then I was like, oh, yeah, it's Andrea. Yes, totally. I would like hire her in a minute. I don't need to meet her. I've already met her. So I know it can often feel like these programs aren't amounting to a lot of things, but you never know who's going to be on the other side. And it actually was really helpful. I already knew her. So it was like I was vouching for her. And so she wasn't just a name being submitted that nobody knew. And so these other things that you can do, these other ways to meet people can eventually pay off. Because it was years before, I think it was a couple of years before that I had worked with her. And then The Porter came along. So that's my idea.
Yeah, the mentoring stuff. I mean, that helped me when I was starting out. I was a mentee in one of those mentoring programs. I think, Marsha, you were a mentor that year or someone else. And, but like through that, I had no contacts. I knew no writers. It was like in the exclusive club, like you're saying, but doing that, then I met people. I got to meet production companies through that. I got to meet agents through that. So it just sort of, any of those things will open the door and then also give you credit. So if you are cold emailing someone, you could be like, hi, look, I have this thing. See, I've been recognized for this thing. And that might be helpful.
And your mentor will probably, whoever that person is, will probably vouch for you. Like, you know, it's like Kurt Smitten says, this script is hilarious. This is his quote, you know, or whatever. Like they probably, like most people who are engaged in that work actually do want to help people, want to help bring people up and change. So I think it can be a very valuable contact.
If I could add, I think it's also important to review your samples every once in a while and see what's going out. Because sometimes when you've been away from something for a while and then you come back to it, you see things that you didn't see before and ways the sample could actually be improved. Because especially if someone hasn't worked with you before, that's the only representation of your work that they're going to see.
Amanda, that's such a good point, because we're also always growing as writers and learning new things and figuring tricks out and sort of shorthands in rooms that we're working on or just in whatever workshops or whatever. And so to go back and apply those to your script, if you haven't seen, that's really smart. Yeah.
You've been listening to Writers Talking Screen, a Writers Guild of Canada podcast. Thank you to our technical producer, Philip Vukovic, and thank you for listening.